We looked at the passage today, and it's Mark 16. We actually read Matthew also at the beginning of the service, but then Allie read Mark 16. And there's a very powerful passage here, and I want to look at that a little bit. What we see happening here is that the two ladies, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James, and then also Salome, these ladies go to anoint Jesus. And it was very early, the first day of the week. That had been Sunday. They go to the tomb, and they're coming, and they're wondering who's going to roll the stone away. It was a tomb that had never been used before, and we know that this was the tomb of Joseph of Arimathea. And as they go to the tomb, they're wondering who's going to roll the stone away. They get there, and the stone is rolled away, and the tomb is empty, except there's a guy sitting there with a white robe on. And then he begins to talk to them. And I have a lot of questions, and one of the first questions is, why is there a guy hanging out in a white robe in an empty tomb? And maybe that's what they're wondering too. Because of all the things that you could be afraid of all the things about tombs that would be scary, this is what scares them. And so I think about this whole burial process and how different it is from our burial processes. And we've just come through a funeral, a lot of us this week, and so we're very familiar with it. The whole idea of having a funeral and then moving on later, and in fact, a funeral several days later after someone's deceased, and then you move from there to the graveside. We actually combined the graveside and the funeral this week, and part of it was the wind, and part of it was accommodating family members, but we combined those at the funeral home. And you think about that, and we look at the gospel, and we forget a lot of times that there was no transition like this. I mean, Jesus went from the cross to the tomb. And there was somewhat of an element of immediacy about this whole burial thing, that it happened quickly, but then once the body was there, it was kind of drawn out. So people didn't go to visit him at any sort of interim place, like a funeral home. They were going to the tomb. They were going to the place where, and this is part of what we understand death is, where we decompose. We begin to die away, wither away. They were going to that place, the place of returning to the earth from which we came. And so tombs were very different also. And one of the things that would happen in tombs, it was a place you actually could walk into. And then there would be along a wall, a kind of ledge or shelf, or I've heard some call it like a bench, where they would lay the body. And it had been wrapped in cloths, but it was laid there on this bench. And so it would lay there until the decomposition process began. And after some time, and they would go in and they would anoint, which really, as I understand, was not a sort of embalming. They were not preserving the body when they did this. They were just paying respects to the person when they anointed with perfume and spices. They weren't making it last longer. They were just honoring this person who was among us. And so the body would be there on this ledge, on this shelf, and as it would begin to go away and decompose, there would be some things left over time, bones and other dry things, which would eventually be swept up, put into a stone box called an ossuary. Watch the History Channel, and they'll tell you about all the ossuaries that they're trying to find, you know, because they're just dying to find this Jesus box that doesn't exist. And so they sweep the things into this ossuary, and then they keep the box there also. But then that shelf, that ledge, is clean. And so the next person in the family who passes away would then be put on that ledge too. So a single tomb could be used for generations in one family. And it's incredible that Joseph of Arimathea was willing to even offer this tomb for Jesus to be buried in. One that had never been used before. Can you imagine the priciness of something like this? And he puts them there. And so as the ladies are coming and they're paying their respects to Jesus, whom they've loved and followed, when many have turned away and ran away, they're coming to pay him respects. And to me, of all the things you might be worried about, walking into that space, not knowing exactly what you might see, you go to a funeral home and you're wondering, what will I see when I look at this person I knew? Will they look like the person I knew before? Well, how about if you go to a tomb where there's someone who's not been embalmed or preserved or put makeup on? How about if you're going to a place where you know that you're still watching the stages of death occur even after they're dead? And you get there and you're wondering, what state or condition will I see? Of all the things that they could have been worried about and afraid about, what scared them the most was that his body wasn't there and that there was an angel sitting there, or there was a man sitting there who was a messenger for them. And he had three roles. His first role, or three primary roles, his first role was to identify that this was the right tomb for the disciples. In fact, when they came in and the ladies came, they probably were like, this is the wrong place. We're in the wrong place. This is the wrong room. You know? And he said, no, this is the right place. You're looking for Jesus of Nazareth. I know who you're looking for. See, this is where he was laid. And there are the claws with nothing in it. And so his first role was to identify the tomb for them. His second role was to give them the message of Jesus' plans, because then he told them, don't worry, go back to Galilee. He'll be there. He's gone on ahead of you like he told you he would. So he gave them directions and instructions and told them where to go. But I think there's also a very, very significant, important third role, because all the Gospels share in it. And this third role is this. He assured them, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. Because they were. They were terrified. In fact, the word terrified is used several times. They were terrified and they went out. And in fact, the passage ends saying they went out and told no one, for they were afraid. And that's strange, because there are places where Mark has ended in this kind of early way, and it almost looks like he was writing and then got up and left and never finished. We're not quite sure what the rest he might have written, but there is an extra verse in there that might be the shorter ending, and some of your versions will say this is the shorter ending of Mark, and there's a little paragraph, and it doesn't even have a verse number. It's between 8 and 9 somewhere. That's the shorter ending. It talks about all the amazing things Jesus did, and he did show himself in and out among them. And then it starts another with a longer ending, and that goes from verses 9 through 16. And those do have verses, and it talks about all the amazing things the disciples would do and the believers of Jesus would do. And whether this is part of the original text or not, there is definitely an element in which this passage ends there, that there's this element of fear that holds in tension this hope. Will this hope actually be effective in these disciples' lives, or will they just end in fear here? Will they take this news and do something with it, or will they end in fear? I imagine approaching the tomb brought so much hesitation. What will we see this time? But their fear was the fact that he was gone. And sometimes the truth is more frightening than what we thought was true before. I think about Mark chapter 5, and we looked at this a couple Wednesdays ago about the Gerasene demoniac. There was a guy who was living among the tombs. He lived among the dead. Talk about somebody who was manifesting what was going on inside. He lived among the dead in the tombs. He used to roam around the tombs and the mountains at night, howling and bruising himself with stones. That's what Scripture says, chapter 5 in Mark. He used to bruise himself with stones and hurt himself. They would put chains and shackles on him. He was so strong and a bit of a madman, he would wrench apart the shackles, it says, and break the chains off of his ankles. And they didn't know how to contain him. And what happened in chapter 5 is that Jesus comes over a boat with his disciples and sees this man and completely delivers him from the legion of oppression that he has in his body. He delivers him. You remember the story? Legion, as they're called, goes into a pack of pigs and then goes over a hill and falls into the water, drowns in the sea. And so the townspeople come up and notice what scares them. This man who used to roam around, who they'd be in their homes at night, and they'd hear howling at night, and the kids would say, is that a dog? And they say, no, that's that guy that doesn't wear any clothes up on the mountain. And this guy was scary. But when they came over to the other side to see what all the commotion was about, and they came and they saw that Jesus was standing there, and this guy that they know to be doing these strange fits of craziness was huddled with a coat wrapped around him. covering up his nakedness, and was sitting down at the feet of Jesus in his right mind with his eyes doing normal things, that scared them. And they were terrified, and they begged Jesus to leave, because sometimes we would rather be wrong than face and admit the truth. You've heard people say ignorance is bliss. Is it really, or is ignorance just ignorance? Because the truth sets us free, but sometimes to know the truth is scary. They were terrified, but they were amazed. And so fear plays an important part in the gospel, and it does in our lives too, that sometimes fear keeps us from ever becoming what Jesus is wanting to set us free into. What does fear do? Sometimes it's fear of the past. Sometimes it's fear of the future. And it manifests itself in so many ways. There's even fears of the present. And I think a lot of times this manifests itself through addiction. Fear, it immobilizes us. I'll tell you what fear does. One thing fear does, it causes us to hide. In Genesis 3, chapter 10, we see the very first presence of fear in humanity. And what happened here is that Adam and Eve had sinned against God. They'd done what He asked them not to. And just about the time that they're recognizing that they didn't have any clothes on, God comes walking through the garden. And He calls out to Adam as if He didn't know what He'd done. And says, "Adam, where are you?" And Adam says, "I heard you coming. I heard you calling my name. And I was afraid because I was naked. And so I hid." Fear hides. Fear prefers not knowing to knowing. I'd rather just not know. Because for some reason, when life is surrendered to God's control, it scares the willies out of us. Why? Why does life in God's control and surrendered to God scare us? Imagine if we had our minds and our faculties as unborn infants. Imagine if we had complete and total awareness of our senses as unborn infants. If we knew what had to take place in order for us to be born into this world, that we would be taking a journey and it would be a change from embryonic fluid to oxygen. And we knew that we would be going from the warmth of a mother's womb to a detached and cold world. That we would go from a continuous supply of nutrients that went directly right into our stomachs to the feeling of an empty stomach with hunger pangs. Imagine if we had total awareness of this. Imagine if it were possible that we could choose our future as unborn infants. How many of us, knowing what was ahead, knowing what we had to go through in order to get to the other side, how many of us would never be born because we were afraid? Afraid of the journey? Afraid of all these things that we would think in our minds, but I'll be without this. And yet, can you imagine the kind of devastation that this would have on the womb of the mother? If we refuse to be born, much less to the infant, just devastating consequences. I mean, it would be total destruction of both the baby and the mother. It'd be total destruction if we refuse to enter into life. A refusal to life is an acceptance of death and destruction, not just for yourself, but also for the womb of creation. And so we can use the metaphor for a baby who's not yet been born. But it's the same thing for us today now. You are in the womb of creation, developing and maturing and becoming more than the fetus than you are now. You will be set free. You will have faculties, you will have abilities beyond our imagination now. Through resurrection life. Paul says something very similar to this is going on spiritually as we are called into Christian maturity. He says, And it sounds a whole lot like he's talking to an infant inside of a womb. He says, I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory about to be revealed in us. It's Romans chapter 8. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the children of God. We know that the whole creation has been groaning in labor pains until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we groan inwardly while we wait for adoption, for the redemption of our bodies. For in hope we were saved. That through Christ, this death has been changed. And because of Him, we understand and can and take faith in this journey that we enter into, which looks like such a struggle, but it's freedom. And He offers us truth, and that is our hope. Through Christ, death is changed. And the journey through the tomb is resurrection. So maybe we should consider that the tomb is just a birth canal to resurrection. That if we want to be born, we enter into the death of Christ. If we want to live, we enter into the death of Jesus. Because as He was raised, so we will be also. We believe this about death. And the implications are in life too, that we are invited to be born again. Jesus said to Nicodemus in John 3:3, He said, very truly, I tell you, no one can see the kingdom of God without being born from above. And a couple verses later, He says, very truly, I tell you, no one can enter the kingdom of God without being born of water and spirit. What is born of the flesh is flesh, and what is born of the spirit is spirit. How does fear lock us up? How does fear deceive us from the truth? And would we rather just not know, or would we rather be set free? Surrender. Surrender to this world is so much bigger than the one we presently know. There's a movie called The Shawshank Redemption, based on a book by Stephen King. And in The Shawshank Redemption, there's a guy named Andy Dufresne, who was an accountant or a lawyer. He was wrongly accused, and he was in prison in this Shawshank. And he had a friend there. Andy is played by Tim Robbins. Red, his friend, is played by Morgan Freeman. And as they're in prison here, they're talking, and there's several things going on. Andy is planning his escape. He's been wrongly accused for all this time. He's been serving his sentence in prison, and he didn't even commit the crime. Now it's time for him to bust loose. And he begins having these incredible soliloquies. And that's just a great word, soliloquy. Anybody in here ever have a soliloquy? It's when you talk to yourself, basically. So he has these great soliloquies. And he says things like this. He's talking out loud. They're thoughts, but they're coming out to Red. And he says things like this. Fear can hold you prisoner, but hope can set you free. He said, remember, Red, hope is a good thing, maybe one of the best of things, and no good thing ever dies. And then there's a particular point where they're sitting against a wall. The time has come. He's planning his escape, and Red is remembering how all this is going to transpire. He said, Red, it comes down to this. Either get busy living or get busy dying. Either get busy living or get busy dying. How often is our hope snuffed out simply because of fear? Simply because of fear. Corrie ten Boom was very well acquainted with fear. She was a devout Christian who from the Netherlands, who in time of persecution was harboring refugees from Nazi concentration camps. She eventually was even put in a concentration camp herself and persecuted for her faith and for her protection. She wrote a book called The Hiding Place. Here's a sentence that she wrote. Never be afraid to trust an unknown future to a known God. What is it that we're afraid? Maybe to release to Him, or for Him to release in us. Is it possible that there's truth out there that we'd just rather look the other way and say, no, I'd rather not know. I'll just stay in my ignorance. The truth sets us free. It is our hope. It is our future. It may be scary, but it's His plan, and it's His good in us.